The Great Famine of Ireland is widely believed to be due to a failed potato crop, which led to mass starvation between 1845 and 1852, and mass immigration from the island nation. However, the famine was not due to a failed potato crop, but rather was a result of a British policy that treated native Irish like slaves and prevented them from accessing other forms of food that would have prevented their deaths. My guest tonight is Christopher Fogarty. He is the author of Ireland, 1845 to 1850, The Perfect Holocaust and Who Kept It Perfect. His website is IrishHolocaust.org. He joins the show to talk about the Irish Holocaust and the cover-up that has been perpetrated by the British establishment. Mr. Fogarty, how are you doing tonight?
Just fine, thank you.
Thank you for coming on the show. Your book and the story here, the story of the Great Famine as we've come to believe this. Tell us about it. What motivated you, and tell us about your book, and what really happened to Ireland in the middle of the 19th century.
Well, I had been taught in school, both in the States and in Ireland, that it was a famine. The people, and we're taught in school that on a permanent basis. We picked up that word, famine, on both sides of the Atlantic. And we worked with that. We thought that had to be the case. It must be true. And I was doing my grandfather's biography in back 25, 30 years ago. And his having been a British soldier, an Irishman who was a British soldier, and only after I did the research on it did I become ashamed that he was a British soldier. I only then learned what the British soldiers were doing. So while I was at the Public Record Office in Kew, Surrey, England, that's now the National Archives, the British National Archives, I found that the regiment that my grandfather joined when he was 18 years old, when he was 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years of age, was removing the food from South County Galway to the Port of Galway for export. He would not have known that, but that's the one he joined. And he was with them in Australia. He wiped out most of the Maoris, or I should say the British wiped out most of the Maoris. And he went to India. He was in India in 1875 when Queen Victoria became the Empress of India. He was marching in Calcutta along with his unit, the 40th Regiment of Foot. So this was a tremendous shock to me. I had no idea that a British regiment had removed the food from South County Galway. So I completed my grandfather's enough information to do his biography, and I continued researching this thing idea of the removal of the food from Ireland by a British regiment. So I re researched the whole thing. I found out that more than half the British army were in Ireland in those years, removing Ireland's food at gunpoint. And what's more, it wasn't the landlord that at that time 95% of Ireland's land was ostensibly owned, nominally owned by English landlords. They lived across the world. They lived in Europe, they lived in splendor, they lived in England, and a few of them lived in Ireland, but everywhere they lived like rajahs. By consuming the production of the hundreds of people who lived on their Irish estates, and again, their titles to those estates was the title of a robber. They had never paid for that land. So I went further and found the mass graves throughout Ireland and located some 180 mass graves from those years. Most of them are not marked, and my wife and I are installing memorials over unmarked mass graves, and we're encouraging others to do the same thing. We're only doing it to give witness to the murdered 5 million people, not 1 million. And we're doing so in order that genocide be no longer permissible as government policy. And for so long as genocides like that one in Ireland, 1845, 1850, it remains covered up, so will genocide remain a potential government policy option. So we must denounce them, we must repudiate genocides. And we must mark the mass graves where we know the victims of genocide were buried. And again, there are hundreds of them. And my book shows about a couple of hundred of them on its map But those that wouldn't fit on the map, I put into a few other pages within the book. So we have much work to do. The world must expose genocide. The Armenians spent decades trying to get the world to pay attention. And finally, I think it's accepted that the Turks murdered 1.5 million or so Armenians in 1917. And that reminds me that when Hitler's advisors told him, how do you think you can get by with what you're planning here? Hitler's response, it's on the record, was, who talks of the Armenians today? Well, he knew enough to talk about them. He didn't say, who talks about the Irish today? Because even he didn't know, nobody knew about what was done to the Irish. And so my book plows new ground. It exposes the truth that had never been exposed before. It names all 67 regiments that removed Ireland's food at gunpoint. And it, the map within my book, the fold-out map, it locates where in Ireland those regiments were located, what part of Ireland they actually starved to death. And so all of that is within the book. My book follows a trail of another fine book, and that is The Great Hunger by Cecil Woodham Smith. She wrote it in 1962. And in it, she briefly, very, very briefly mentioned 13 British regiments and their removal of Ireland's food. But she buried it under so much other information, mostly false, sad to say, that it didn't change my mind. I didn't, when I finished her book, I didn't start saying, I'll never say famine regarding Ireland again. I will say Holocaust or genocide or extermination. So, but I didn't do that because she buried those few truths under 450 of other pages of nonsense. So I did what she started to do. And by the way, it's my understanding that she buried those truths under such other layers of falsehood in order to get published. At the time, she was smeared for having mentioned the 13 British regiments. Again, my book names all of them, and it shows where they were located, and when they came into a region, and when they left that region, whether to another district within Ireland or to overseas. But every movement made at the time, my book registers. So you can see every single movement made by British regiments in Ireland from January 1845 to January 1851. And it's pretty extensive, quite, in fact, it's a comprehensive work. A writer in the Irish Independent newspaper on October 16th last referred to my book as the definitive study. And I must say that pleases me no end. I had intended it to be such. I did not think it would be publicly declared such so soon. I thought it might take 4 or 5 years that the smears would come first. But in this case, the acknowledgement came pretty much first. The first printing was done in the United States, Akron, Ohio, and printing number 2 and 3 were done in Dublin. The second one was just a month or two ago in Dublin. The third printing, but the second Irish one was done in Dublin about 2 months ago. So that's where we are. Any questions you might have so far or challenges? I relish challenges because in trying to be the spokesperson for the murdered 5 millions, I must do the best job possible because so far I'm the only spokesperson. I'm hoping that will end as soon as possible. And I must say, I'm a weak reed. I wish that burden were not upon me. And I'm begging others to learn the facts, defend them yourselves. Do not leave this job to me. But do challenge me, because I must do the very best job I can for them. They have been for 170 years, 169 years. They have been not alone murdered, but in death, they have been smeared for that long. All those tens of millions of head of cattle of all kinds, those tens of millions of tons of grain and vegetable products of all kinds, that was all produced in Ireland by Irish hands. No army of English workmen came over to Ireland to plow and to harrow and to seed and to cultivate and to harvest all those crops. That was the sweat of Irish labor, and it was all robbed from them by the British army abetting those English landlords in Ireland. Well, something that maybe I should mention here is that Ireland was rid of its English landlords all between 1900, and nearly all, essentially 90 some percent of them were repatriated to England out of Ireland, and their land was sold, was taken by the government. The British government bought them out at above market prices, all again between 1900 and 1910. So none remain in Ireland. They're all gone now. And their land has been redistributed. The land of Ireland is now better distributed among the people than the land of any other country in Europe now. And that's a good thing to say. On the other hand, my father and all of his neighbors in County Roscommon, up through long after I left, they were still paying that annual rent in addition to what they call rates. The rates are the taxes on real estate that maintains the roads and keeps the schools and everything else going. But in addition to those taxes, those rates, they paid an annual rent that amortized the amount given to the old English landlords. So they received the land back in our area in 1913, and they were paying those rents as if they were still serfs on the old landlord's land. They were still paying that into the 1960s, late 60s, maybe 1917.
So what you're saying is you have the forensic and documentary evidence to prove genocide, and that's also backed up by the fact that during the Great Hunger, in the midst of the Great Hunger, the 1845 to 1850, Ireland maintained a brisk food export market. They were exporting food when people were starving to death in Ireland.
That is correct. All of that food was not released by its growers voluntarily. It was removed from them by more than half of the British army. It took more British firepower to remove the food produced by the Irish in Ireland than was needed to conquer the Indian subcontinent, which is now today, which is India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. It took more British troops to starve Ireland than to conquer that subcontinent.
Interesting, because India suffered several famines too because of British policy. So there's a interesting comparison there between the two suffering nations. What you have here, you mentioned half the British Army, so basically about 100,000 troops at one time were garrisoning Ireland to make sure that the food was expropriated and exported?
Yes. However, that was a total of 67,000 regular British Army troops brought in from around the world, the Empire troops. But there were then 37,000 militia troops. They were actually the army of the local landlords. Mm-hmm. They were all engaged. So that makes the 100,000. And then there were some 12,900 constables. And how the food was removed is that the constables would make the first effort. And by the way, those constables were armed with carbines, the most modern of equipment. And if they were on horseback, and many constables were on horseback, they had their carbines and also a brace of pistols. They were the first force to try to remove the local produce, the local wheat, oats, barley, livestock, cured meat, barrels of meat, butter, dairy products, poultry products, the whole thing. They were the first force to remove it to the nearest port for export. When they ran into difficulty, they summoned the local militia, that is, say, the landlord's armies. And those regiments had 1,000 men in each also. When both forces combined, when the constable, the constabulary, and the militia combined were having difficulty, they then summoned the British army from the nearest garrison town. And the three armed groups never failed to remove the food from any district.
Now, one of the primary myths underlying the potato famine narrative is the idea that Ireland was overly dependent on potatoes. Their agriculture was too narrow. But based on your research, based on what I've read, is prior to the English policy, Irish agriculture was as diverse as anything on the continent or in the United States at the time. The dependence on the potatoes was imposed. Is that correct?
That is correct. In other words, okay, everything you're growing belongs to me, except the potatoes, which failed this year, and therefore they belong to you.
Jeez. Okay. Wow. Okay. That's the primary. I think that's the primary myth or the main misunderstanding people have. It's why they call it a famine. I think as recent as 10, 15 years ago, the Irish president Mary Robinson called it the greatest natural disaster.
That is correct. In fact, yeah. I received that in a pamphlet from what's called Ireland's Famine Museum in Strokestown, County Roscommon, not far from where I was raised. And the president of Ireland told that lie and put it on paper under her own likeness, her own photograph. And that false statement is made by her, the president of Ireland at the time. It is shocking. And by the way, that so-called Famine Museum attracts people to it, tourists to go there. And as you go, entering that big house, the castle, hoping to learn which regiment starved your own people, you are diverted to admiring the old English landlord's his castle, his furnishings, his architecture, both works. And that particular English landlord, Pakenham, it was he who got killed, a relative, a nephew, got killed in the Battle of New Orleans. He was the British general.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
The attack on New Orleans.
Yeah, that's right. Pakenham, yeah. General Jackson, yeah. Back then, I think it was Colonel Jackson at that point.
He was our man, but the British man was General Pakenham, and he died in New Orleans. And in fact, his fellow general, General Ross, who burned Washington, was killed a few days later at Baltimore, where our national anthem was created. Mm-hmm. And General Ross, he was from Ross Trevor, County Down. So the notion that these were Irish land. Oh, by the way, there's been a new lie created once my pamphlet got around and my website, IrishHolocaust.org, became fairly well known. And they stopped denying that food was removed from Ireland. The lie that the only potato was grown in Ireland, that lie no longer could stand. So the people who had promoted the notion of potato famine all those decades developed a brand new lie, because they had to acknowledge the huge torrent of Irish food that was being sent over to England and to the Empire and to German markets. And that new lie is that it was the rich Irish starving the poor Irish. So that is what is also completely refuted in my book. I name the landlords, and I name the estates that they actually have in England at the same time. And their names are not Irish. They're not Gaelic. They're all English names, or Scottish, or nearly all English. And they're members of the Church of Ireland, which was the name they gave to their own Anglican church. Essentially, the entire Irish nation were Catholic. They did not become Protestant. They probably would have, except the people who were murdering them were all strongly Church of England. So the Church of England in Ireland, called the Church of Ireland, it was where the genocidists went to pray.
Yeah, it's right. You had the Protestant Reformation in the early 16th century, or the English Reformation under Henry VIII, but it really became intense, after Elizabeth I, whose legitimacy was in doubt, and I think she felt threatened by the Catholic nations, and so that, I guess, that factored into English politics. But the split between the Protestant and the Catholic world enabled people like Cromwell to carry out his policy in Ireland, at least facilitated the poor treatment meted out to the Irish people because they were Catholic.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he felt it was his Christian duty to murder as many of them as possible, particularly children, on the basis that nits become lice. He brought a few shiploads of Irish down to Jamaica, where he set up a slave state. In 1654, he set up the slave state of Jamaica.
And I suppose the Irish didn't fare too well in that environment.
No, they didn't survive anywhere. I worked in the Caribbean for years, and Montserrat, near Antigua, I had a contract for the U.S. Navy on Antigua, and I took a trip over to Montserrat, well, just nearby, and it's called the Emerald Isle, and there's a shamrock on the gable of Government House, and a few of the place names were Irish, but none survived, and it's very touching. I'm pretty sure that solar radiation would wipe them out fairly young in their lives. On the other hand, by 1776, with the new free United States, anyone who could get away to the United States would do that. Mm-hmm. And so you can't say that they all died in the Caribbean. Some of them might have made it to the States. We all hope they did, of course.
Well, that might have made it into the American South, which there was a large Irish population in the American South. And of course, we had after the potato famine, they piled into the eastern seaboard of the United States, which is why Boston, New York, and Philadelphia have such large Irish populations.
Yes. Yeah. By the way, I'll have to send you my book, and I must get your address because.
Oh, thank you.
Because when you read it, you will never again say potatoes or famine regarding Ireland. Because they're the cover words. They were the means by which a genocide has been covered up all these years.
Well, yeah, the famine's the cover story, and I think you mentioned in another interview that I listened to how Prime Minister what was his name in the 90s?
Oh, Blair.
Blair was Tony Blair. Yeah, Tony yes. Blair. Said it was indifference. They stood by and let it happen, and something quite different occurred. It wasn't indifference. There was a deliberate policy.
Well, the cover-up artists and the particularly shameful ones in Ireland itself, including Irish politicians, they praised him for that cover-up lie. And here's how it was a cover-up lie and not the truth. He said that England he was apologizing on behalf of Britain for the British government having stood by while the Irish starved, that they failed to deliver enough charity food into Ireland. At the same time that he's saying that they had stood by, they had more than half of the British Empire in Ireland perpetrating that crime. So it's a little bit like blaming Hitler these days only for failure to deliver enough gas masks into Auschwitz, if gas is ever used.
Yeah, I think on your website you say calling the Irish hunger there is like calling a potato famine is like calling the Jewish Holocaust the oxygen famine.
Yes. And so I'm hoping that in time, that if we will ever succeed in abolishing genocide as government policy, we cannot use famine and all that stuff regarding Ireland. But also, I'd like to let you know that when famine was being discredited as an acceptable label, the big lie operatives immediately went to work and said, "We speak Irish. So trust us, the word we should be using is an gorta mór, which is the same as famine." and an gorta mór is actually the great hunger. So the hunger is merely symptomatic, not pejorative. And obviously, it's exculpatory, not inculpatory. So if we're going to tell the truth, we must get the labels right also.
Well, it's like saying someone has been murdered and saying, well, they ceased to live.
Yes. Yes. Or they died of somebody died. Strangled. Somebody strangled him to death and they say he died of oxygen deprivation.
Yeah.
That's where we are.
Well, you have a few quotes here. One is from Queen Victoria's economist, Nassau Sr.
Yes.
And he says he feared that the existing policies, the hunger policies, would not kill more than 1 million Irish in 1848, and that would scarcely be enough to do much good.
Yes.
Thomas Carlyle, the great essayist, wrote, "Ireland's like a half-starved rat that crosses the path of an elephant. What must the elephant do? Squelch it, by heavens. Squelch it. Total annihilation." And that was on September 2nd, 1846, in the London Times. So you have some of these, you know, leaders and luminaries of British culture, of politics, advocating, genocide by hunger, by forced starvation.
Yes, that's what it was. And by the way, that's the first one that was imposed. One of Elizabeth's generals, and in fact, Spenser, the great poet Spenser, he called for burning all Irish crops, killing all Irish livestock. That hunger works much faster than the sword, and that hunger must be the means by which the Irish are wiped out.
That's very important, because usually in wartime or policies, that is the way that people are killed, because it's labor intensive to kill each and every person. You simply cut off the food supply. I mean, I'm thinking the policies of the Bolsheviks in the 1930s in the Ukraine, not only to extract the wealth from that region in order to facilitate the industrialization of the Soviet Union under Stalin, but also to destroy the kulaks, the independent, so-called wealthy farmer, independent farmers, and to destroy the Ukraine as a source of problem for the Stalinist regime. You also have – well, British have a history of using hunger to win their wars. I mean, you have the great hunger blockade of Germany in the First World War, which not only killed probably about 1 million civilians, but it also set the stage – I think it changed – set the stage for – next 20 years, which led to the Second World War, because it was the bitterness and memory of the hunger blockade, which contributed much to Hitler's policies to the breakout of the strategic, dilemma of Lebensraum. Yes. So, so these things have consequences. But even more recently, we also have, such people, great people in the United States, like Henry Kissinger, suggesting food as a weapon in 1974. And so it continues to be a weapon.
It continues to be. Yeah. And the so-called great Randolph Churchill murdered something like 7 million Indians heavily around what is today Bangladesh, and removed the food unnecessarily. Now, it was toward the end of the Second World War, and food was scarce in Europe, but it wasn't so scarce that they should remove the food from its producers, some 7 million of them. And there was in an earlier one in the 1700s under the East India Company, 10 million people had been wiped out. So that's been a British policy for a very long time. And I fear the direction our U.S. government is going. I don't want to bring up another subject now. But our government has gone a long way toward being the British Empire government of today. It is, what a pity, what a loss.
Well, it's funny because, not funny, funny in a sense that it's interesting. You mentioned India. Of course, India's famines were brought, I think I alluded to it earlier, because the British wanted to grow indigo and poppy, opium plants. And that upset, traditional agriculture there.
Yeah. Well, they also shipped out. They also continue to ship out vast amounts of food to world markets.
That's right. That was in World War, especially particularly in World War II, to secure the food that really wasn't needed at that point, 1944. But that's first of all, how did they get away with this? And I think you might have alluded to this earlier, is Britain's policies of empire. Is empire is as much a cultural as it is a political and economic and military project. It's spreading your culture, your vision of the world, and making sure the people you colonize internalize it and accept it as normal.
Yes.
I think much of the United States has been reconquered in such a way. I think that's the whole idea of the Rhodes Scholarship.
I think so. That was an empire builder's idea, indeed, Rhodes.
Yeah. You incorporate the United States culturally, intellectually. This is particularly because the Eastern Seaboard elite of the United States were all Anglophiles. But they got the German immigrants and the Irish immigrants to fight the wars on behalf of the British Empire in the last century.
yes, they did that.
Yeah. And we're taught, we're supposed to – why was Ireland neutral in both world wars?
Well, yeah, they didn't buy the notion that this was to save small nations. Mm-hmm. The idea of saving Belgium, that Belgium was a small and by the way, also Catholic nation, that somehow the Irish should participate. They saw what was being done to themselves at the same time. and they didn't see any reason whatever to fight on behalf of the of their own oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, however, like my grandfather and so many others, they did join because a colonized people usually don't have any jobs other than as servants of the invader. And you could probably ask any Iraqi today, mm-hmm. what jobs are available to you? You know, translators, spies, you can go through the whole list.
Yeah, yeah.
And the people in Ireland were reduced. And what's more, for a couple of 100 years under British rule, it was a felony crime to educate your children. And it was a felony crime to be a teacher. And so the people had been reduced to illiteracy and until 1828. Then they were barely allowed to become students or to have schools again. And so by 1845, the people were just emerging from their illiteracy. And they were kept on the very edge of death. That is, 90% of their output was robbed from them on the basis that everything they grew belonged to the person on whose land, supposedly the owner of the land on which it was grown. So there might be 500 families on an Englishman's estate of 15 or 20,000 acres, but all of their work was owned by that English landlord. So they lived like rajas while keeping the people who did all the work living on the very, very edge of death by starvation. And what's more, when they would build a house that was barely habitable, worth living in, they would be evicted in order for the landlord to rent it out at a higher price to somebody else. So everything worked against a family working to their own benefit. It was actually harmful to a person's survival. It endangered their survival to create better conditions for themselves. Everything they did was to the benefit of the English landlord, and that's how they lived. And another feature is that in addition to being made humble by the law working exactly against you, they were also non-persons. So being non-persons, they had no recourse to the law because the law defends only humans. So not being human, according to the law exists only to punish you, not to defend you. And that's how they lived for hundreds of years in Ireland. So in 1828, they got some of their civil rights back again. They continued tithing to the church of their genocidists until 1869. And that's when they stopped having to pay 10% of their produce to the English state church called the Church of Ireland. So it's, in a sense, I wish I had never learned Irish history. It is an unbelievable saga of genocide that went on for hundreds of years, for many centuries. And I wish I had never learned it because it is a burden. The narrative part of my book, only less than half of my book is narrative. The larger portion of it is exhibits in the legal sense of the word, evidence of crime. It provides the amount of food leaving on just a typical number of days as reported in the London Times. And it reports where the army was, what they were doing, the trouble they were having in removing the food, where the church stood. And it's a shame to say that the Catholic hierarchy of Ireland were spokespeople for British Empire at the time. Now, there was a price on the head of all priests in Ireland for centuries, but that ended in 1828. And from then on, a little bit before that, actually in 1795, the British government named a couple of bishops, got the Pope to name a couple of bishops to the British Parliament, and from then on, they became servants of the British. So they would exhort the people off the altars of all the Catholic churches in Ireland to abide by the law, the demands of their oppressors, and not to follow the terrible examples set by those ungrateful Americans who disrespected their mother country by rebelling, and to not get any notions like those like and would denounce them off the altar and excommunicate them.
That's it seems to be a great portrayal of but essentially the hierarchy was bribed to ignore the genocide.
That is what happened. The bribery wasn't total. Not every single bishop was bribed, totally bribed, but only two that I know of were not. Mm-hmm. The rest were bribed and acted as if they were bribed. And that's a very, very sad thing to say about a religion, that they were working against their own people and on behalf of the people who were murdering them.
Well, because it was the Irish monasteries that saved Western civilization.
Yes, that was earlier, of course.
Yeah. I'm saying there's no gratitude.
yes, that's true. They went with the power. The Pope went with the power.
Now, it's also there's the issue of the mass graves, and of course, this might be part of the reason why the Church participated in the cover up is because the Church turned a blind eye to all those children who perished without the benefit of baptism. Correct.
Yes. Now, I know those children know, I think everyone was baptized at the time.
Okay.
But those baptized people were not granted burial. If they starved to death, most of them were denied Christian burial. Yeah, they were denied burial in consecrated ground. And that's a shocking fact. And a memorial that my wife and I just installed in Kilkeven Cemetery, just on the edge of Castlereagh, the original Catholic cemetery of Castlereagh, County Roscommon. And I went to school in Castlereagh. We lived in a little farm outside Castlereagh. And there are four mass graves in and around Castlereagh. And so we put up this memorial at one of them, the oldest of them. And all of them were buried outside consecrated ground. So our memorial is where the people were buried. And that's a shame. And it took me 25 years to get permission to get it done, because there was occult obstruction coming. I didn't know for sure where it was coming from, but I know now that it was the local Catholic parish priest. And
to this day, they're still trying to cover it up.
To this day. Yeah. Right now, as we speak, there is a sort of an impasse between a Catholic priest who founded a parish in Venice, Florida, Our Lady of Lourdes Parish in Venice, Florida, who, after reading my book, decided he would put up a memorial over the Holocaust mass grave nearest to his mother's birthplace in Northwest County Mayo. So he had put up a couple of other gravestones over his relatives in that same place. So he was familiar with both his first cousin who lives there and the local monument maker. So he contacted both, told them what he wanted, but he got no reply. And so he recontacted and pushed a bit harder. And finally, after a number of months, he got a reply, not from the monument maker, but from his first cousin. And his cousin told him, "Father," and they won't give his name, "tells me, go ahead, Father, down in Florida, if you wish, with your memorial, but use the word famine. Do not use the word Holocaust." And I wonder, anyway, that's where it stands today. The parish priest in Ireland is keeping that mass grave unmarked against the wishes of a Catholic priest in the United States. And that's an impasse today. Just a little over a week ago, my wife and I got another one up in Sparmore Cemetery, outside RD in County Louth, over north of Dublin, just south of the border, Northern Ireland. And we got that one done pretty readily. You have to get through a few fields to get to the cemetery. It was the location of an old monastery back from the 6th or 7th century. And People haven't been buried there in quite a long time, but there's a huge mass grave there. More than half the cemetery is a mass grave from the start, from the Holocaust. And they were brought there in cartloads from the RD workhouse. And no mark of any kind from ever until the one my wife and I put up. But we name the two British regiments. Oh, by the way, in any monument that my wife and I put up, we always name the British Army regiment that murdered the people in the grave. And that's the only way that we can give proper, how would you call it, true witness. The idea of bearing false witness. We will not bear false witness, and to leave the notion continue, the lie continue, that somehow potatoes are that the people had fallen into a trap of their own making by growing only one failure-prone crop. We will not tolerate that. We insist upon bearing true witness for those murdered people. So we named the perpetrating regiments, the specific perpetrating regiments that starved that particular community. And we're proud to do it, I must say.
Of course, the idea of the Irish just relying on potatoes also went with the insult that the Irish were simply primitive and stupid, and that's how they were lampooned in the British press at the times to sort of justify the mass death, just
Yes,
dehumanize them.
that dehumanization must always precede genocide. Not so much that it affects the targeted people, the people who are doomed, but in order to get the soldiers to perpetrate the genocide in the first place. See, it's the soldiers that won't perpetrate it unless they are demonized, unless the targeted people are demonized.
It makes the killing all the easier.
Yes, not cap. You're not killing people like yourself.
But one thing you mentioned also is the fact that the Irish people have internalized the British narrative. Want to get into that? How that sort of that perpetrates or facilitates the big lie?
I find that difficult to understand. You would think that any sense of national self-pride would result in people wanting to defend their own people who were murdered. But in Castlereagh now, when I first started, it's 35 years ago since I first started suggesting to my ex-fellow students that they form a little group, and my wife and I will put up a memorial over the mass grave, all four of them, if they would tolerate it. And they all seemed initially, they all were initially enthusiastic. But there's a pecking order in Ireland, and I don't quite fully understand it. But they became afraid. The very people who were initially enthusiastic later became afraid, and then actively started seeking plausible reasons to avoid us, to say no. And that's why they took my pamphlet to the Marist brother who taught us in Castlereagh. And were disappointed when he said that my pamphlet was all factual, because they were looking for to have a pretext for avoiding me, to say they wouldn't do it for some specific reason, but they were left without a reason. And eventually, by the way, there was eventually a monument put over one of the workhouse's mass graves in Castlereagh, and it's a memorial to the workhouse. And it even got the date of the workhouse wrong. Everything about it is false. And yet that's the only monument, except for the one that Mary and I, my wife and I, got up last year, is the only monument over any mass grave in the Castlereagh area.
And these workhouses were instruments of the genocide.
They were.
Yeah.
That's where people were sent to die. Very few people came out alive. They died in their thousands in those places. And in the workhouse in RD in County Louth, when they started bringing them in car the bodies in cartloads to the mass grave where we now put up the new memorial, about 4 miles away in up the fields in Smarmore. That was only after the workhouse grounds. There would be typically 7 acres of land on which the workhouse was built. And the original purpose of the 7 acres was to have gardens where people would grow their own food. But they eventually filled the entire 7 acres of open land, or 6.5 acres perhaps, of open land with bodies, and couldn't put any more in there. and that's why they would have to haul them somewhere else. This is shocking, shocking stuff. When it came to the building, eventually, back in the 70s, there was a housing development planned to be built on top of the mass grave of the workhouse of Castlereagh. And by that time, an ex-schoolmate of mine had become an excavation contractor. And he got the contract for excavating for all the houses. And he told me how they were digging up, jammed together, bodies of toddlers. That was the part that he was excavating. It was all toddlers. And he said they dug them up and dumped them into trucks and hauled them away. And they were being dumped and hauled away to dump. And that there were no separate burials. The children were all thrown in on top of one another, buried in pits. And it was in trenches. And they would run the trench across, a very deep trench, six or 8 feet wide, fill it with bodies to within a foot of the surface, and then fill that and then spread the excess soil around, and then move the trench, keep moving the trench forward, back and forth across the open space. And that's how it was done. They would move as the body, as the people would get sick, they would move them to an upper floor to where there was a permanent chute attached, and as they to a window, and as the people died, they would be shoved down out the window, down a chute, into the mass grave or into a barrel to where they would be wheeled to the mass grave. And this was a regular operation. They were very efficient title guarantee means by which the English landlord got clear titles to their estates, because everyone in those workhouses had been landowners, and at least they were from the time that they used to own their own land. But so there was still an awareness that the land was theirs, but the English landlord had claimed the whole thing for many miles around, and to get into the workhouse where you were promised some kind of food, you would have to sign away all your land except a quarter acre, and that's how the English landlords got title of the land again in 1845 to 1850. But they're all moved out of their land and off their land between 1900 and 1910. It was a disastrous times for Ireland. When Michael Davitt, who was the leader of the Land League in the 1860s through 1880s, when they finally achieved the sign-over of the land, again, starting in the 1880s, but not really moving, not really completed until 1900, 1910. When his family was evicted, he was a toddler, and his mother and father decided that his father would hurry off to England and get some kind of a job in a house, and that she would go into the workhouse with the children of Swinford, County Mayo, until the husband would send for her. So the husband went off to England in the morning, walking to Dublin, and sailed across. But before he was still on his way, when she went into the workhouse and found out that her toddler children, would be taken away from her. Because in those workhouses, men were separated from women, therefore husbands from wives, boys from girls, and toddlers from everyone. So toddlers were kept together, boys were kept separate, girls were separate, men were separate, women were separate. So there's five different categories of people there. So she was separated from her children. When she found that out, she walked back out of the workhouse, I believe saving her life and the lives of all her children. And she started walking to Dublin, about 140 miles from her house. And she made it across the Irish Sea somehow to Liverpool, and walked from there to Harlington in Lancashire, where her husband had gone. And there they lived. And when Michael Davitt, then a toddler, when he became 9 years old, he went to work in a local textile mill. And when he was 11, he lost his arm in the machinery and it was amputated. And then he then got a little bit of an education and became the leader of the Land League for Ireland, those who put pressure upon the English government and tried to get the world's attention to what was being done in Ireland. And he, and along with Charles Stuart Parnell, they got an old, an Anglo who had the prestige at the time to join the effort. He was another fine man. And those two men, with the help of Irish America, were able to save hundreds of thousands of people's lives in Ireland in those years.
Yeah, well, yeah, the Irish flourished so well in America that pretty soon you had more Irish in America than you had in Ireland.
Yes, in fact, there are far more people with my name in Australia than there are in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Because my people, by the way, the Kellys largely came from the middle of South County Galway, around Ahaskra, Ballinasloe. My people lived in around Turles in Tipperary. In fact, the full name of Turles, Turles comes from Durlish, strong fort. But the full name in Irish is Durlish Aileogarty, the strong fort of the Fogartys. It was rich land in the Golden Vale, and they were expropriated, and therefore they were bouncing around, creating a little bit of difficulty for the people who had robbed them. That they were converted and they were made felons, arrested and convicted on anything, and sent to as slave labor to Australia. Another unbelievable. By the way, if you get a chance, and your listeners, pick up a copy of Hughes's, Robert Hughes's, The Fatal Shore. F-A-T-A-L, Shore, S-H-O-R-E, The Fatal Shore, What Happened to the People Who Were Sent as Felons to Australia. It's a shocking read. The book was very, very well researched, and he was later put in charge of the main museum of New York, New York City Museum. I'm not sure the title of it, but he was there. He died a young man just a few years ago, Robert Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S. By the way, a little aside here. 2 years ago, I bought an ancient book, and what do you call it? And the word for them, a very old book in any event, antiquarian, at an antiquarian book show in Chicago. I bought what might be the oldest book in the place. It was printed in the 1870s, and by a man who was claiming to have found the original ground of an Irish king of 3,000 years ago in the corner of County Meath that extends over near into County Cavan. But in the very lengthy preface to it, he was leaning heavily upon the work of the Four Masters. The Four Masters is the name given to four very highly educated Irishmen who wrote the history of Ireland between 1832 and 1836. The reason they wrote it in the first place is that they had just lived through the end of Queen Elizabeth's genocide, and they were going through the Jameses, or Charles, and they thought that Ireland was going to be wiped off the face of the earth, that neither the language nor the people nor their history was going to survive, that all would be swept aside and completely obliterated. And so they decided to leave a record of the Ireland that once existed. Three of them were brothers of the Christian religion, and the other was Mulconry. And anyway, they at the Franciscan convent of Donegal town in County Donegal is where they sat down to write the history of Ireland. They used all of the printed material of the time, much of which is now gone, by the way. So their work remains the surviving work, and it's there yet. And it's the annals of Ireland from essentially the time of Christ forward. I don't know what record they would have, but in any event, from the time of Christ forward, but particularly in denser as the years go by. And it's in four volumes. And it mentions in that book that I bought that one of them, a man by the name of Cucogri in Irish, O'Cleary, with a given name, a nickname of Peregrine, like the Peregrine Falcon, because he had traveled so much, taught all over Europe, that he had removed himself to Ballycroy in southern Erris in County Mayo. And I wondered, did he leave any survivors? So I have a set of Irish telephone books here of 2000, and I looked through and I got the Mayo set, and I looked for O'Clearys, and there were no O'Clearys. But I knew that many of the O's and Macs had dropped those from their names as things really got bad, as my own family did, and yours too, Mr. Kelly. Yours would be O'Kelly, and mine was O'Fogarty. In any event, I looked for, so there were no O'Clearys, so I looked for Cleary, and I found a Cleary and in Ballycroy, and so I called up a Martin Joseph Cleary. And I said, told him my name, told him about the book that I had just bought. And I said, would you by any chance be a descendant of one of the four masters? He said, it has always been rumored, but there's no proof. I said, that's a pity. It'd be nice to know if he did leave survivors, because I said he did leave, according to this preface to the book I just bought, he left two sons, John and Dermot, after he had moved to Ballycroy in County Mayo. He said, well, all I can say is that it's a rumor. Well, I said, just for your, in passing, before I hung up, I said, well, just, you know, this man's name who moved to Ballycroy from Donegal, his true name was Cucobri in Irish, but I said his given name was Peregrine. Well, he said, I've got a first cousin, Peregrine, who was born here in Ballycroy and moved to England back after the Second World War and lived and died over there. I said, Martin Joseph, you have just established that not only your cousin, but all of your cousins in County Mayo and you are descendants of one of the four masters, because Peregrine might not exist. His cousin might be the only one in Ireland, and it can only have come from within the family. So the family tradition had lasted until that person was baptized. And by the way, there is a Saint Peregrine, oddly enough, and he's the saint for cancer victims. Mm-hmm. I've never heard the name in all my years in Ireland, and it has to have come from the relation. And since then, since that man was born back in the 1930s or 20s, the family had forgotten the connection. So it was reestablished by virtue of the preface to the book I bought.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah, it is. I'm delighted. So since then, they're very intelligent people. And a cousin of his just did the history of the Clearys, of those cousins in Ballycroy, County Mayo, for the last century and a half. And it's sad to say, but a genocide can be successful. So even though they had a tremendously enlightened ancestor, when that person moved after completing that history, along with the other four writers, and he moved into Ballycroy and procreated and survived, he started from then on delving in the bog, trying to make a living out of agriculture in infertile ground. Mm-hmm. They were both murdered by landlords, a couple of them evicted by landlords. They had participated along with the rest of the population as if they were had no personhood.
Yeah.
So that genocide was successful. It kept those people down from 1632 until you must say today.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You keep people on the cusp of starvation, and you won't have a culture. No culture will be allowed, because there simply isn't enough resources or time or mental energy to devote to, you know, things cultural.
Yeah. And by the way, during the starvation years, during the years of the Great Crime, the people who could speak a little English had the best chance of survival, for the obvious reason. Just like Iraqis today who speak English, or better yet, English with an American accent, they have a better chance than people who don't know English.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I hate to have to say that, because I'm a proud American, and I a very patriotic American. I served my country in the U.S. Army, and I wish abiding by its own standards. It's so disillusioning to see what's going on. But in any event, our subject today is the starvation of Ireland.
Now, one thing that you got into is the sort of the complicity of academia in covering this up.
Yes, and I'd like to bring in a positive note in this terrible, terrible subject. I know an Irish history professor who wrote a book about 4 years ago, a very important book about Irish history, and it got zero peer reviews. So he almost lost his livelihood. So he's got young children to feed. He dare not publicly tell important truths anymore.
Well, that's how it's done.
That's how it's done.
Yeah.
But he is teaching his students covertly. So he's giving them, while he's running them through the process of giving them the standard test and all the rest, he is covertly teaching them the truth between himself and themselves. And therefore, I have to salute him and say, keep lying if you must publicly to be able to feed your children, but also, above all, keep teaching the truth, even though you must do so covertly.
Now, before I let you go tonight, you yourself have been a victim for this cause. You've tried to publicize the true nature of the Great Hunger. It was genocide perpetrated by the British establishment, and you were subjected to an attempt to frame you for a triple murder by the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
That is correct. It turns out, and I wish this were not true also, it's such a huge embarrassment to any patriotic American. The FBI is a criminal organization, and I now fear that so is the CIA and NSA. But they framed me for a triple murder of people I'd never heard of in my whole life, nor did I ever know the murderer. And FBI agent Buckley did that. We always thought that he was a rogue agent. We were told he was a rogue agent.
That's what they always say.
And what he prohibited the local police from pursuing the only suspect they named, and all the police got together on the local chief the afternoon of the murders, where the people were found, the Langert family, and they were asked to each person privately write down the name of any possible suspect on a 3x5 card. Minutes later, when the cards were handed in, there was only one name on the cards, and that was the name of the murderer. But the following day, FBI agent Buckley arrived, and he prohibited the police from pursuing their only suspect and sent them off on wild goose chases against the IRA. He got FBI agent Buckley got Carol Marine, our local TV anchor, to break that false news of Irish involvement in those murders, and the rest of the news media parroted her. After a few months of that, he then framed me for those murders, seemingly using my own words, and I could not have prevailed. The word, what it was, is that they say, if they have themselves asking me, FBI, if you were to commit a terrorist murder, how would you go about it? My question would have been, what the hell kind of a question is that? they have me answering, I would use different type bullets in my gun. And then below that was note, different type bullets were found at the murder scene. To escape detection, I would use different type bullets in my gun. That's an insane statement, but they were painting me as insane anyways. So I could not have prevailed against that. But the murderer, David Biro, saved my life, I believe, at least certainly my freedom for the rest of my life. He saved me by blabbing through his FBI cover into life without possibility of parole, and he remains in downstate Illinois Pontiac prison to this day. But then on the day that Biro, the murderer, was convicted, the same FBI agent raided my home here, came crashing through our door, arrested my wife and me, roughed me up, handcuffed us, marched us out through the front lobby of our building, down to the federal lot downtown. Two others, a wonderful old man, Frank O'Neill, with whom we had done wonderful human rights work, and another, Tony McCormick, locked the four of us up in the federal lock up downtown, and would have sent us to prison for the rest of our lives, based upon a completely different set of crimes, of false, of supposed crimes. And it took us 15 months. So we were locked up in November of 1991. And we defeated them in federal court in January 1993. And we defeated them by proving that the only evidence upon which the crime was based, the charges were based, was an FBI audio tape that was criminally fabricated. I since wrote, shortly after, I wrote to the judge demanding that he notify law enforcement of the crimes perpetrated in front of him in his courtroom, and he wrote back to me on official stationery saying, as the judge in that courtroom, I am not allowed to make any arrests. And I said, for some reason, you have misrepresented my demand of you. Not that you make the arrests yourselves, but that you abide by your minimum requirement, that you uphold the law, that you notify law enforcement of the crimes perpetrated in front of you in your courtroom. He didn't reply to the second letter. So why these crimes were perpetrated, we couldn't understand. We really could not get it, and we further could not get why the United States would be involved in sending the same FBI agent who framed me twice and my wife once, why the same FBI agent would be sent over to Ireland in 1994, where he remained until the evening of August 15th, 1998, the evening of the bombing murder of 29 people in Omaha, to be blamed, like the Langert murders in Winnetka, Illinois, on the IRA. When they then say that the IRA had done it, and it was an IRA bomb, but it was not an IRA massacre. That massacre was planned by those who were involved over there for MI5 and FBI agent Buckley. They murdered 29 people. We couldn't understand why would the U.S. government be involved in framing my wife and me twice, my wife once. Why would they be committing crimes for a foreign power? Because our human rights work that they were objecting to was, my wife and I led the campaign in Illinois, a successful campaign that got the McBride Principles for Fair Employment in Northern Ireland enacted into law. And it directed funds to pension funds in the state of Illinois to be distributed throughout as they wanted them dispersed. But any company that would participate in the policy of job denial to Catholics in Northern Ireland not be invested in.
Okay, yeah, like a divestment movement, yeah.
Yeah, and so there was no disinvestment, but how it worked is that in 1973, after a very lengthy campaign to be allowed to vote, there was no universal suffrage under British rule in Ireland's six counties. So in 1968, the Irish people living under that not allowed to vote condition campaigned for the vote. They were clubbed into the ground for 6 years, and their leaders were imprisoned and all the rest until 1973, when they were allowed to vote. The British government responded by calling upon all employers to not hire Catholics in order to starve them out of the country and therefore off the voter registration rolls. We in America, once we learned about that, we decided to try to get at least the American companies over there to not participate in that job denial program. So at that time, there were 25 U.S. companies were employing 11% of the working population of the six counties. So it would have made a difference. Mm-hmm. We went to work and we did that. But that's why we were targeted. That, and of course, my work on the starvation of Ireland, they were the reasons why we were targeted. So why then? Why was it so important to do work against justice and against democracy for a foreign monarchy? And it turns out then that the neocons were already planning their wars against Islam. I would never know that, but there was a book published 2 years ago, entitled Voices from the Grave, in which the head of the Ulster Volunteer Force, that's the main Protestant British, actually, we shouldn't talk about religion because religion is really not involved. It's all politics. The main British terrorism group in Ireland, the Ulster Volunteer Force, who had murdered around 800 non-combatants as part of a terror campaign to soften them up to get to sign over the six counties to Britain, to sign, what was being fought over, the whole thing was eventually signed over to Britain. And so that ended that. So we didn't know that that was the purpose. We didn't know that that was the outcome of all these crimes. But later in this book, it points out that when David Irvine, the head of the Ulster Volunteer Force, when he was invited in triumph to the White House in 1994, he accused the head of the Britain desk of the U.S. State Department of favoring the IRA. And they were not. So in Irvine's own words, the head of the Britain desk said, we do not favor the IRA. We're on the British side. The IRA do not have Buccaneer bombers. They're the words. They do not have aircraft carriers. And we, the American government, must sew up the British exchequer so as to use British forces in our upcoming wars. And David Irvine said, and we all looked at him, the head of the Britain desk, and the Britain head of the Britain desk said, Islamic fundamentalism. Mm-hmm. So the wars against Islam were planned as early as 1994. So the notion that 9/11 was the cause of our invasion of Iraq is, that was merely the pretext. Mm-hmm. It even raises the question as to why building number 7 at the same time, and exactly what was the cause of all those buildings falling.
And the BBC is there reporting it before it collapses. The British Broadcasting Company.
Yes.
Jane Stanley, yeah.
So I hope that you are as offended as a patriotic American as I am of all of these crimes by our government.
Well, I like to say, I think it was H.L. Mencken who said that it is the duty of all decent men to be ashamed of the government they are forced to live under. So America isn't the U.S. government.
Yeah, that's right. We have this government, but it wasn't always this shameful.
It's gotten worse, yes. It's maybe more out in the open, perhaps. I mean, go throughout history, the great crimes. Think about how the Native Americans were treated, the lies that led to the First World War, the lies surrounding the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, COINTELPRO, Operation Chaos, MK Ultra.
You're a little ahead of me because, you see, I was kind of happy to be in the American Army.
But it's a generation. I think it's a generational thing. It's a generation that's brought up on newsreels and Walter Cronkite. You know, later generations may perhaps. You know, it's a double-edged sword because you get a lot of weird. You know, you get a lot. It's a lot of crap with the good, with the information we get.
Yes.
But I think a certain section of the population, I wouldn't say everyone, younger people, a certain section of younger people might be more a little bit more sophisticated and cynical.
Yeah. But how can we as American citizens make America what it claims to be? how can we make it more American?
It never has been what it claims to be. But yeah, I know, I get your point. It's how can we move it more towards the ideal? And I think America, you know, decided to become an empire, and that's largely done at, I think, a British encouragement.
Yes. When do you think it happened? When was that decision made?
Oh, I would say I think the documentary evidence suggests it was the late 19th century, the Union Now movement, the Rhodes Scholarship, the development of the telegraph with the British control. Technology played a big part in it. You simply couldn't have as much control with the lack of technology. Once they mastered communication and steamship travel, it became more practical.
Well, when FDR made his basis for battleship swaps,
yes,
in what, 1941 or so,
yeah,
that was demolished the British Empire. Maybe the first demolition occurred in Ireland in 1916, but that went a long way. All of those British Caribbean islands,
yeah,
they changed massively at that time.
I think what happens is, I think if you get the British, what exactly was the British Empire? I think the British Empire was the City of London, the financial district, and they used the resources, the people of Britain and Ireland and their empire, the same way that the Anglo-American, you could say Zionist perhaps, of the Atlanticist powers, maybe is a better term, utilize the resources of the United States and around the world. They do it through the monetary system, through the dollar, you know, the petrodollar system, through the MI6, the intelligence agency, CIA. These are agencies working for the benefit of the corporate elite, who I think probably effectively control things. You know, the maybe the royal families, like the royal family of Britain, Queen Beatrix, these people, these perhaps are the true power that we're dealing with. They are the they, I guess, perhaps. But I'm speculating. I don't know myself. Who's at the top of the pyramid? I don't know.
You know, it doesn't make any difference how who's at the very peak of it. It's probably figureheads at the peak. But I would suggest that the dynamics of it are our American neocons and all of their allies in government positions
Well,
around the world.
that's funny because if you, I mean, you went into this as the neocons, a lot of them are Jewish, the Zionist, and you know, that goes back to British Philo-Semitism and some of the intrigues of the Rothschilds. And has this idea of Israel been used by the elite, like the Rothschilds? You know, some people claim that the current people in charge of Israel aren't really Jewish. They're the Ashkenazi or so.
Khazars.
So-called 13th tribe, and they're utilizing this biblical mythology to justify these things. That's a whole other can of worms. But I mean, really, I mean, if you get into British, if you get to Cromwell himself was funded by Amsterdam Jews to introduce the Jews back into England, and he.
You know, in my book, I didn't make any real mention of any Jewish involvement in the genocide in Ireland, except to quote someone who talked about where the Irish food went to. Some of it went to Spain for wine for the landlord, some here and there. And a lot of it went to the Jews in London who had the mortgages on the land. And maybe that should be developed. And they might have been the ones calling the shots, but I
It's a
must.
well, it's a touchy subject because if you start attacking Jewish elite, they immediately, invoke the anti-Semitism card. And that's a ploy. I mean, obviously it's a tactic they use to immunize themselves from proper criticism. That happens. And what I mean, in America, a good example in America, Neil Gabler is a Jewish writer who claims that boasts of the Jewish control of Hollywood, and writes about it. And it's a great thing. And then if you criticize Hollywood and say and you criticize, well, you can't take collective credit for Hollywood without accepting collective blame for it. I mean, it's just like you can't have, of course, you can't have your cake eat it too if you control the media. And of course, the Irish don't control the media, which is why no one has heard about this genocide. You know, I'm not justifying the injustices perpetrated against the Jewish people throughout history.
Of course.
I'm just putting it in its proper perspective and also acknowledging that other people have suffered as well. And I would also like to throw out there that many of the injustices perpetrated against Jewish people are a result of policies advocated by the Jewish elite. And they should take responsibility for that, and they don't.
They didn't even mind the abuse by the Nazis in Germany on the basis that maybe it would drive them to Israel, which is what they wanted.
It facilitated the Zionist project. Yes, they needed a crisis, and they got it. But it's just one of those things. It's interesting. I didn't realize until fairly recently. I was just reading about Cromwell and that, and and that came up, and so I didn't realize how influential Jewish money from Amsterdam was. And that goes back to when I think it was not Charles the First, the 12th century when they were expelled, 13th century when they were expelled from England. And they wanted to get back, and Cromwell was Cromwell. You know, he as a Protestant, he saw Great Britain as a new Zion.
I see. Well.
So there's the ideological. Same with the Puritans that came over to America, and this factored this sort of messianic view, and this and of course the Protestants become the Yankees, and the Yankees. This justifies their destruction. And the destruction they wrought against the American South. You know, this very so this ideology, this view does it reverberates throughout history.
I must say, I'd like to have personal contact with you in the future, going because you're as well informed a person as I think I've known in quite a while.
Oh.
What part of the States are you, please, Timothy?
I'm sorry?
In what part of the States are you?
I'm in Northern Virginia. Just outside Washington, D.C.
I was stationed in Fort Lee, Virginia once.
Okay. But it's you know these things. I'm still trying to sort a lot of these things out, and that's what, because we definitely haven't been given the true story of history. Of course, why should we ever think we are in these things? Because the victors write the history books, so.
Yes, that's it. That is it.
Now, in closing this out, I mean, I think in your book, is chapter 13, you list things we should do from now on to correct this false history you've been given. Do you have that at your disposal to kind of give us a few of the pointers you had?
I'll have it in 10 seconds.
Oh, great. Because I think that's a great way to close it out.
Yes, I'm just now whipping through it. I'll have it in a flash.
I don't put you on the spot. I'm sorry.
Chapter 13, what we must do, it's actually a very short chapter. Above all, number one, spread the truth. Number two, excise, quote, famine from our vocabularies regarding Ireland. It offends truth, dishonors the utterer, and constitutes false witness against the murdered millions. Number three, politely but promptly correct all, including news media, who continue to refer to Irish, quote, famine, unquote, or, quote, potato famine, unquote, or their Irish synonym, that'd be Gortamore, great hunger, etc. Boycott institutions that teach Irish, quote, famine, unquote. Block proposed, quote, memorials, unquote, that don't name the perpetrating regiments. Install a reverent truth-telling memorial over the Holocaust mass grave nearest to your ancestral home. Join with relatives and friends to do this. See Exhibits A and A2. On those memorials, do not fail to name the regiments that starved that district. Visit some of the mass graves and ponder the crimes. Observe November 3rd, Irish Holocaust Commemoration Day, annually with appropriate solemnity and respect. Remember that that date commemorates two official events. One, the beginning of that Holocaust, and two, the beginning of the big lie, quote, famine, unquote, campaign. Locate and keep a register of all mass graves of Ireland's Holocaust. There is some evidence that in areas of fertile soil, thus of denser populations, the mass graves are roughly a mile or two apart. Thus, there are probably more than 3,000 of what can be considered mass graves in Ireland. For now, contact me, Chris Fogarty, C@ATT.net, with their precise addresses for registration. Means must be developed to ensure accuracy. The last one word is then, work to permanently preclude government policies of genocide. This will be partly accomplished by ending the cover-up of Ireland's Holocaust of 1845-1850.
Excellent. Excellent. And your book is Ireland, 1845 to 1850, The Perfect Holocaust. And who kept it perfect?
And keep in mind that that's perfect with quotation
of
marks.
Of course, yeah. In quotation marks. And your website is irishholocaust.org?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you can call me later, I'd like to. By the way, you don't have a copy of the book. How do you know so much about it?
I listened to your interview on Red Ice and just read and went to the website and just read the website and just did a little research on the topic itself, you know. So
if you can send me your postal address separately by Skype or any way you want, and you have my email address, that's even better. There can be no mistake then, and I'll send you a copy of the book.
Excellent. Thank you. That'd be great.
Thank you so much. We must get the truth out. And by the way, I have no, how would you call it, no author's pride is involved in this book. This is done for the 5 million murdered people. Mm-hmm. And any criticism that come, I welcome all of it, because the whole point is to make it as precise as possible. Mm-hmm. I believe I've nailed it. It's been referred to in the Irish Independent newspaper in Ireland as the definitive study. I really glory in that. I didn't expect it would come so soon. But I want to improve it on behalf of the people for whom I'm trying to speak.
Excellent. Great. Well, listen, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me tonight and sharing with us your research on this topic. It is a topic that sorely needs to be reexamined and be revised. And as we so much about history is bunk, and we need revisionism. I think the entire 20th century needs to be revised in many respects. So, Mr. Fogarty, thank you.
Thank you. And by the way, this book is a complete repudiation of everything we've ever been taught about those years in Ireland.
And yeah, that's why it's so important to understand, because it really does, yeah, it changes your perception of history.
It perfect. And it, by the way, the information in it, there's essentially no opinion. The information comes from food shipments from the as reported in the London Times of the day, the deployment of the army records from handwritten records from precisely that time. I have two copies made by the British National Archives, exactly where the troops were, when and where, and the location of the mass graves is all there. The responses by the various politicians, it is truly the definitive work. However, I do want to improve it.
So, listen, well, thank you. And
Thank you.
good night. And I'll look forward to that book coming in the mail. It's great. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Good night then.
Good night.